I'm going to say this. I'm going to let it sink in for a minute, and then we're going to get going. The Senate of the United States is set to vote on a bill overhauling the entire tax framework of this economy, and that bill's not even written yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, December the 1st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not. The Senate's tax bill is literally, as votes are being rounded up, a work in progress. So we are not going to talk specifics. That would be folly because those specifics are still changing. We are, though, going to talk big picture, how we got here and what happens now. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. They are both in our studios in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Sudeep, let me start with you and on this thesis of the bill still being written, which is actually not a thesis. It's the fact. The GOP said they were going to do four things with this bill, right? Not increase the debt, take care of the middle class, wealthy aren't going to benefit, and going to grow the economy. How are we doing so far with those four things?
And that was all wrapped up in one giant promise that they need to win something. They were telling themselves they needed a win. They were telling their constituents that they were going to deliver tax reform. And however they do it, they know they have to deliver something. They've had loss after loss in trying to repeal Obamacare on a whole lot of other fronts. So they came up with their own legislative process resembling some of the worst practices that they've seen over the years and decided to drive something through. Again, as you know, we don't know what this is. This is not true tax reform. It doesn't simplify the mammoth tax code all that much. Nobody's going to be firing their CPAs or filing taxes on a postcard, but they want something. So in all those areas, they just want to get something out.
Right. Anna, talk to me for a second about a thing that is empirically observable when you talk to Republicans about this. They say things that are demonstrably not true, right? They say that the tax cut is going to pay for itself, and yet the Joint Committee on Taxation last night comes out and says, no, it's really not. And I don't understand how that happens.
Exactly. So yesterday, the Congress's official scorekeeper said that, in fact, this deal wouldn't pay for itself. In fact, it would blow a hole in the budget that was $1 trillion. That isn't some change in the couch cushions. That's $1 trillion. So basically what we've learned is that the Republican Party actually doesn't care that much about deficits when it comes to getting this political win. It is a deal that estimates show is likely to generate some growth, but certainly not enough to pay for itself. And one of the more interesting incidents we saw in the last day actually was this lonely stand by Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, who was the only one who was insisting that this bill actually try to pay for itself to some extent.
Yeah, totally. Let me actually, Anna, stay with you. You cover mostly trade and in the international economy. There's no small slice of this that is America in the global economy, right? The repatriation rate that's coming in and the taxes that are going to be levied on graduate students, many of them from overseas. It's a very sort of in line with the Trump philosophy, right? Sort of draw up the drawbridge and sort of see what we can do by ourselves.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the issue, though, is it's unclear what exactly the economic outcome of it is going to be. So the goal revolves around generating investment with companies and boosting growth that way. And as I said, most estimates do think it's going to boost growth. But at the same time, you have interest rates that are already low and companies are sitting on a lot of cash right now. So there isn't really that much to prevent them from investing in the U.S. economy in the first place.
Right.
And you also have very low unemployment. So it's possible that, you know, because the economy is already operating pretty well, the growth boost from this plan won't be all that large.
Sudeep, let me change gears here for a second and go to a Trump administration win on Monday. I guess it was Tuesday the decision was made that Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, would also actually be able to be the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It is another step in the we are going to do what we want. As Mr. Mulvaney said, elections have consequences.
Elections do have consequences. They first give us a bizarre situation like we saw this week with dueling potential leaders of the CFPB.
Which, to be fair, was what Cordray did, right? I mean, Cordray is the guy who appointed Leandra English on the way out.
Exactly, but this was partly due to the unusual structure of the CFPB, and it was a carve out during the recovery from the financial crisis, where this was built out of a crisis, and Democrats had a big win going into it. Now they're going to see the ramifications of creating an agency that does not have the usual structure and controls of other federal agencies. And so we don't know how much of that infrastructure is going to be ripped apart in the CFPB. Everybody who we're hearing as possibilities to take over all seem to hate the agency and want to undo it. But it's just another reminder of how quickly we forget. This was we're a decade out from the financial crisis. There are still scars from the crisis all over the country, all over the world. And there are some shrugs going on in Washington about this, saying, "Hey, we're moving on. It's time to do what we want politically."
Shrugs in Washington about a lot of things, I would venture. Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Anna Swanson at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, really, it was a lesson in the power of narratives. Things were going along just fine, thank you. Tax cuts, yada, yada, yada. And then the Mike Flynn plea deal broke. The Dow promptly dropped 400 points, but, oh, right, tax cuts. All three major indices worked their way back to almost break even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
I own a company. We pay a corporate tax. I'm fine on paying the corporate tax. And I just do not believe all this rhetoric about the fact that we're the highest corporate tax rate in the world. We are not. And it's just appalling.
If I were going to change one thing, I would leave the rich alone and let them, they struggle as they are. So I would leave them in the same bracket they're in, and I wouldn't do away with the inheritance tax or any other benefit which directly inherited the rich. Then there's more room for maybe cutting some taxes for the middle class.
That was Betsy Berkemer Credere from Ventura, California, just up the coast, and George Fear from Putnam Valley, New York. All right, a little bit more on taxes here. We know from a couple of different budget models that have gone over the GOP's tax plan, as Anna Swanson was saying, most recently last night from the Joint Committee on Taxation, that this bill could add as much as 0.8% to economic growth over the next 10 years. But hang on a minute here, because that's economic growth for an economy that is already heating up. And you know who you call when the economy gets too hot, right? The Federal Reserve, that's who you call. It's entirely possible the Fed is going to have to come in and put the brakes on the very growth that the GOP has been promising. Marketplace's Sabri Benishwar has that one.
There's many an economist who would argue that this is a pretty weird time for a tax cut.
It's a particularly bad timing.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. A tax cut will put money in some people's pockets to spend. It'll be, he says, a stimulus. But doing that now is like pushing on the economic gas when you're already at the speed limit. Look at the unemployment rate. Zandi says it's headed to under 4% next year.
That's about as tight as labor market as I've seen as an economist. I've been doing this for almost 30 years.
If Americans take their tax cuts and start spending more money in the next year or two and threaten to overheat the economy, the Federal Reserve may have to get involved. Don Cohn is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
It is the Fed's job to keep prices stable.
Meaning the Fed might have to raise interest rates to prevent or control inflation. If that happens, you can kiss some of the promised economic growth from this tax cut goodbye. It'd be like pushing on the gas and the brakes at the same time, says Moody Zandi, who calls the tax cut a wash.
It's going to be costly. It's going to add to the nation's deficits and debt. So, pretty expensive way to go nowhere.
That is, however, assuming this tax cut will create much growth in the first place. Kent Smetters runs the Penn Wharton budget model, which predicted the tax cuts would increase GDP 0.8%.
But keep in mind, the 0.8% increase, that is over 10 years.
If you break that down annually, it's like 0.8% growth each year.
So that's usually just not big enough for the Federal Reserve to get too excited about.
But in that case, it's not a lot of GDP growth for anyone to get too excited about. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
All right, slight change of gears here. Mark December the 8th in your calendars, gang, one short week from today, but it is a week in which a lot has to happen. Government funding runs out next Friday, and the party that controls both houses of Congress is floating a plan for a short-term fix to keep funding flowing until just before Christmas when, yes, we would have to do it all over again. But the point here is, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, negotiations to keep the government open are an opportunity.
Funding the government is generally considered one of those must-pass bills in Congress, but it's also one of the bills you can't just squeeze through on a party-line vote. Nancy Vandenhouten is with Oxford Economics.
Democrats have some leverage here.
That leverage can be used to demand more hurricane funding or action to protect DACA recipients, especially in the Senate, where the GOP has a narrow majority.
And if a lot of the more conservative members of the House refuse to back spending bills, Democrats are going to be needed there.
And of course, President Trump could throw in demands for border wall funding. Plus, there's all the deals the GOP is making to push through their tax plan. Gregory Warrow is a political science professor at Columbia University.
Given what the Republicans are currently doing on tax reform, my bet is that the Democrats will be asking for some pretty steep concessions.
Concessions like funding for health insurance subsidies, for example. He says the political dynamics give Democrats leverage as Congress attempts to avoid a shutdown.
But ultimately, they may end up with more leverage if a shutdown occurs and the public reacts negatively, as they have in the past, to government shutdowns.
Because history tells us voters blame the party in power for shutdowns. So why not just do another continuing resolution to keep government funding as it is now? Charles Tiefer teaches law at the University of Baltimore.
That would be a real black mark when you remember that the Republicans hold the House, the Senate, and the presidency, that they can't even get a budget through for any time during an entire year.
Not really a good look. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Like raising the child credit, I think that's a concession that was made to sort of placate people, but I don't think it doesn't affect people who don't have children. People who are paying off mortgages, they won't be able to deduct that anymore. I mean, I think it's terrible for families. I just think that all the money's going to the wrong place.
It just seems like it's going to be a disaster for the middle class. As someone that's expecting their first child and was hoping to make some improvements to our home, I think it's going to be unfavorable for us at this time.
That was Sherry Shapiro from Philadelphia, PA. Also, John Greer from Benton, Arkansas. Largely lost in the tax bill frenzy of the past couple of months, and really the general news frenzy as well, was this. Authorization for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP as it's known, ran out at the end of September, which means millions of kids and pregnant women are at risk of losing coverage. There are some bills in Congress that would fund it, but nobody can agree on where to get the money. It's a $15 billion program that sends federal money to states, which those states use to subsidize health care for some families. The upshot of the whole thing, though, is that without congressional funding, some states might have to cancel CHIP coverage altogether. That includes Texas, where Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
Michael Adamis, a 57-year-old retired retail store manager in Conroe, Texas. That's about 40 miles north of Houston. He's got two kids, a 15-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son with Down syndrome, covered through CHIP. I ask him what his contingency plan is if the program's shut down.
I really don't see what my plans could be. I really don't.
His only source of income is disability, so he doesn't have the money to pay for their insurance on the open market. But his kids won't qualify for Medicaid either.
The only choice we have is to go back to the emergency room, because we know they're going to have to get taken care of.
As he puts it, use the emergency room as a clinic. Adami says he hasn't gotten any official notice about Texas ending the program, but he's heard rumors. Trish Riley is executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. She says this uncertainty puts states in a tough spot.
So the states worry that if they send out notices saying that this is a program in jeopardy, they may create panic and then find themselves a month later saying, it's okay, we have the money now.
Funding for CHIP has been perpetually in question. Alice Chen is a health economist at the University of Southern California. She says because CHIP isn't attached to something bigger, like, say, a tax bill or defense bill, the uncertainty will likely continue.
I don't know if it's going to ever change. I hope it will, though it seems like the reauthorization for the funding is fairly short. It's, a span of 3 years, a span of 5 years. And so the program gets extended for a short period of time, but never really permanently.
That impermanence has the parents of the more than 400,000 children in Texas and 9 million across the country wondering about paying for doctor's visits next year. I'm Ada Euler for Marketplace.
I really think we need to explore a flat tax for everybody. I think that a flat tax would work, that no loopholes, no paybacks, everybody pays a certain percentage, doesn't matter how much money you make. So you're going to, in that case, care for those that are your lower middle income or even low income.
As a grad student, I'm really concerned with getting rid of the tuition tax waiver. It would tax me on the entire tuition to go to school instead of just what I make every year. It would make it really difficult to go to school at all.
That was Kimberly Stickley from Roland, Arkansas, also Jeremy Reed from Phoenix. Before we do today's numbers, here's a tip for you. For as little as $5 a month, please consider signing up as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust, and the payoff comes with what you hear every day. You might not know that we're a nonprofit news organization, one that's on a mission to increase economic intelligence all across this country. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll do more of it and reach more people as well. You can donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Coming up.
He didn't make any money on the book that was supposed to be a money spinner for him.
In true Dickensian fashion, you might say, but first, sure, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials wound up just a 0.1% down, 40 points, close to 24,231. NASDAQ off about a 3rd percent, 26.6847. The S&P 500 gave up 0.2, about 5 points, 26.42 there. That was the day. For the week, the Dow up 2.9%, the S&P 500 up also 2.9%, NASDAQ rather, down 0.6%. Barnes & Noble says its stores have too much stuff in them, too much clutter. The giant bookstore chain is going to start phasing out gifts and games and other tchotchkes to make space for more books. I don't know, and investors agreed. Shares of Barnes & Noble down 2.8%. Today you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the likely losers in any final tax bill is going to be the renewable energy industry. Both the House and Senate plans reduce or eliminate tax credits and deductions for wind and solar energy programs. Bad news for them and for the climate. Good news in coal country, where tens of thousands of jobs have disappeared as clean energy has gotten stronger. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports now from one small corner of Pennsylvania near the West Virginia border, where despite low pay and an industry in broad decline, a whole lot of young men are investing in coal as their future.
This here has a valve on right here.
It's mid-morning, and Adam Maley is in a packed classroom at the Career Center in Greene County, Pennsylvania, learning skills of a dying profession, coal mining. Today, Maley and roughly 20 classmates are being shown how to stay alive by breathing properly during a mine emergency.
Put your respirator on, you keep it on, you do not take it off. Couple breaths and you're going to be on the ground.
They pay $200 apiece for this two-week course. Despite huge layoffs and a shrinking market for coal, mining still has a hold here. Even if, as Maley says, its rebirth hasn't exactly been realized.
I fell into the common error that, you know, I thought that the day Trump got elected, my troubles was over.
President Trump's campaign promises to revive the industry were enough to lure Maley back to coal country from Miami about a year ago. Regulations have been rolled back, but the jobs, they haven't followed.
It doesn't seem the case. We're kind of at the bottom of the barrel here.
When Maley completes this course, operated by GMS Mines, which provides contract workers to mines, he'll be trained for a job that pays $13 an hour.
If I could make $30,000 a year, I'd be happy. I wouldn't be comfortable, but I could make it.
Opportunities to be more comfortable are just down the hall, where classes for growing fields like healthcare and trucking are offered for free. They're funded by government grants for retraining that went to states like Pennsylvania, which were hard hit by the collapse of the coal industry. But Amy Gatz with the Workforce Development Board says they're mostly empty.
Pennsylvania got $2 million. We didn't spend all of our $2 million. West Virginia has spent $7 million and could spend more.
Coal may have a better past than a future in Greene County. The number of mines has shrunk from 12 to 3, and the days of the unions and good salaries are long gone. But of the 10 biggest employers here, 5 are coal companies. So workers, says Gatz.
They're going to have some questions and doubts, but I think they're committed to it because in Greene County, it's been here for hundreds and hundreds of years.
If I had a young son that was looking at the coal industry, I'd say look somewhere else.
Blair Zimmerman is chairman of the Greene County Commissioners and a retired coal miner. He made a good living in the mines, taking his kids on ski weekends and summer vacations and putting them through college. His job now is to move this region past coal.
Shame on people before me in my position. Should have been looked at 50 years ago. What can we do beyond coal? My goal was to try to get industry manufacturing here in Greene County.
But it hasn't been easy. He's up against companies like GMS Mines, which sells the promise of a coal job as the route to the type of comfortable retirement common a generation ago.
The idea is that you go in there and you embrace the opportunities that are being given to you and you are noticed. And the more noticed you are, the more opportunities will come your way.
That's Mary Beth Miner. Her name is a coincidence. And she's a recruiter for GMS Mines. Just because the industry has changed, she says, doesn't mean it's going away.
Oh, I think coal's going to be here for hundreds of years. As long as there's coal to be mined, this industry is going to be here.
Two men come to her office, done with the refresher course and ready for work. Miner runs through the paperwork, gives them drug tests, and they're off.
You're free to go.
I got to find all my equipment now.
Hard hat, long sleeves, long pants, metatarsal boots, mining belt.
They provide gloves.
Yeah, I'll see you in the morning.
All right.
As I'm leaving, she hands me a business card. She has 100 jobs to fill before the end of the year, she says. In case I know anybody looking to get into coal. In Greene County, Pennsylvania, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
I mean, I think the text could need to be more simplified. To me, it's very confusing and, you know, college educated, have a master's degree, and it's pretty complicated. So I can't imagine other people trying to pay taxes and they don't really know how the whole thing works, you know.
Well, I think actually what I found really interesting about it is how nobody actually knows what it says, including people who do a little bit of tax like myself. It's really surprising, and I think it's really interesting to hear people opine when nobody knows what it actually means.
Nobody knows. Let me say this again, because the thing is still being written. That was Russ Frank from Houston, also Alvin Velazquez from Washington, D.C. The holiday season is well nigh upon us, and with it come some tried and true classics. A Christmas Carol, arguably first among them in my book. In a new book called Mr. Dickens and His Carol, author Samantha Silva tells the tale of how Charles Dickens came to write his story, and it turns out wasn't so much about holiday cheer as it was about debt. Here is this year's first installment of our annual series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
What I've done is playfully reimagined how he comes to write A Christmas Carol. And the book is very much draws on the truth of Dickens' life. He was, in October of 1843, deep in debt. He'd been a literary rock star in his own time, very aware of his celebrity and of his influence. The Times of London said that he had risen like a rocket, but would sink like a stick. He had four children, with a fifth on the way at 31 years old, lived a lavish lifestyle, but also was himself a profoundly charitable man. So Dickens had a conundrum when his publishers came to him and said, Martin Chuzzlewit is a flop, and you'd better find a way out of it because we're going to start deducting from your pay £50 sterling per month, which would have ruined him at the time. One of the great ironies of A Christmas Carol is that Dickens created it, wrote it in 6 weeks, and did it absolutely because he needed a money spinner. And it ends up, of course, being the clearest, most crystallized argument of his, of a Dickensian vision of the world, and not only at Christmas, but for all the year, about how we must be responsible for those who have less, and that the only antidote to our own selfishness and greed and miserliness is generosity. While Dickens did create it to make money, he didn't, ironically, make money in the moment, because he wanted A Christmas Carol, the book, to be a beautiful book, the salmon-covered cloth and colored etchings and gold at the edge of every page. And he wanted it to be priced at 5 shillings so that people could afford to buy it and offered to pay for it himself. So he didn't make any money on the book that was supposed to be a money spinner for him. But of course, he's probably saved theaters in the English-speaking world since then who rely on putting up A Christmas Carol every year as really their bread and butter.
Samantha Silva, her book is called Mr. Dickens and His Carol. This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of Don't Do That. A Harris poll done on behalf of Travelers Insurance shows a whole lot of people are using their phones while driving, either as an actual phone or, worse, emailing or texting. 43% of people surveyed admit it, and they say they do it because they feel the need to be available for work at all times. Number one, don't let your boss do that to you. Number two, we all know 43% is probably low, right? So seriously, don't do that. Tell you what, man, I do not know what that music is about. All right, our theme music, not that stuff, but our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.